All right, it's 7. Oh, there we go. It's 7 p.m. I'm going to do a roll call. Mr. Boren, and when you indicate your name, can you also say permission to record? Member Boren?
Yes, permission to record.
Member Poby?
Permission to record, here.
Member Ludden?
Yes, permission to record.
Member Underdunk?
Here, permission to record.
Here, Brooks?
Yes, permission to record.
All right.
Okay, so then
I call
the October 6, 2020 Committee of the Whole meeting of the Black Hawk Cargo order. Lisa Shepherd, please call the roll another time.
And I just did, out of order. So we are
out of order? Out of order! I accept it. Okay, so it's our practice not to address questions at this time. However, we will take comments under advisement. For our posted policy during the coronavirus crisis, comments may be submitted via email to Executive Director Lisa Shepherd prior to the meeting. Lisa Shepherd, please read any public comment received via email.
I have not received any via email. I see there's a couple, I think one person from the public on the Zoom call. Do you have anything to say?
Okay, so if there are no attendees who would like to make a verbal comment, we will then move to the next item in the agenda. And I presume...
Hey Lisa, Bart just came on. I don't know if he has to say, if you want to say anything real quick before
he's
on.
I just wanted to listen in, and I guess the only thing I'd say is I live fairly close to the new linear park, so I'm very excited about that concept and progress.
Oh, thank you.
Awesome. Okay.
Right.
And presuming there's no one else, we will then move to the discussion on the 2021-22 levy amount, and Carol will lead the discussion.
Oh, good evening, everybody. Included in your packet for the meeting today is, you've probably noticed, it looks very similar to what we've done in past years, and I think it's been very helpful to lay it out the way kind of explaining the process itself and how the levy is completely separate from the budget process. The levy is the ability to tax and to receive revenues from the community. The budget is the ability to expend those revenues, of which typically 50% of our revenues come from taxes and 50% come from program fees and user charges, which, as you all know, amidst the pandemic, that's not going to be the case this year. The taxes will make up a larger portion of our revenues, as can be expected. But last year, the CPI, which really is the guiding variable by the county, that we have to limit our tax extension to whatever the CPI is, or 5%, which is ever lower. So last year, that CPI was 1.9%, meaning all regular, I call it old growth, excluding new growth, new development, new teardowns, new subdivision. Old growth is capped at that CPI level. And this year, that CPI was 2.3. It really relates to what the CPI was last December. So that's the good news, in that whatever we levy, that capped amount really does increase by 0.4% compared to last year. And the key, no matter being in the pandemic or not, the key to the levy, and I've had a long discussion with Michael today as the treasurer and Dudley yesterday, is that it's really a kind of a backward process. We're actually estimating or levying a certain amount that, based on the levy's calculations, we won't know until next June or July, and our fiscal year starts in March. So that's consistent from year to year. What we always try to do is we do it out of a philosophy of fairness, that we aren't capping the new growth. The county doesn't cap any new growth. So we always levy what the CPI is, and then build in a percentage for new growth. And that's the philosophy that we're continuing to do this year. Our new growth over over the last 10 years has been under percent. But knowing that there are certain properties, the Hoover Estate and what happened there, I still think it's a little early that we would see any new growth out of that subdivision. We want to start taking a look at that, and would typically build in 2.5% of potential new growth, knowing that we want to at least levy enough to capture what the actual new growth was. And last year, as I mentioned in my memo, new growth was only 0.63% of that EAV increase. So we captured all the new growth. The county still puts a cap on it per the tax cap legislation that they passed back in 1994, I believe it was. And so the goal in this meeting is to provide you with information on page 7 of your packet, your PDF packet, is really a fund-by-fund comparison of what the extension was last year and what we're proposing as far as a levy amount, knowing that we will not get that full levy amount at all. And that we would propose a 4.4% increase in the operating levy, knowing we very well could just be capped at the 2.3. The big distinction from prior years is that typically I would propose a levy amount within corporate and rec that's kind of consistent, 2 to 3%. This year, because we have lost so much in program revenues, and obviously then the related fund balance will decrease more drastically than our corporate fund, I'm proposing to do more in the recreation fund than the corporate fund. And still, as you know, doing the bond issue, the 2020 bond issue, the board knew there was going to be an associated tax increase of approximately $36 for the average homeowner. So this year, the debt service levy, which is totally separate of the operating levy, will go up accordingly for a total tax levy of about 4.99%. That's what the request is to the county. That does not mean, again, a 4.99% tax increase. It's not that our budget is going up that. That's just a levy request. And tonight, I just want to get your consensus for that, for maintaining that philosophy. And then next regular meeting, which is October 20th, there's a truth in taxation resolution that's passed by the board, basically stating this is the levy extension for the current year, this is what we're proposing, the debt service next year in total. And the hearing, the levy hearing, only has to be held if the increase on the operating side is more than 5%. We have traditionally, even though we have not passed that 5%, we have always held the levy hearing to allow people to voice their thoughts on that. So I am this year would like to do a proposed levy increase, I believe, of 4.4% for the operating side. We would still hold the levy, and the breakdown on page 7, as you see, would be broken down according to this summary. I also put the history and samples of both the tax resolution and the publication notice that goes to the paper. But it again is consistent with previous years of levying the CPI plus adding an amount for potential new growth. And again, it's kind of weird because we will not know the final extensions till next June or July. Are there any questions that you might have?
I just noticed that the special recreation was a negative decrease. Is that because we devoted money? Oh, you probably explained it here. Sorry.
It really is kind of the fact that we're right near the maximum rate for special rec. We have been increasing it the last several years to kind of get up to that level because we do provide ADA-related expenditures related to our master plan capital projects. We can pay for them if approved through the special rec agency, NSSRA. I just felt it was more important this year to devote a little bit more to recreation because we have built up the fund balances in the special rec fund. And I also know they did not bill us for the second half of companion fees, so we saved more money there. And would just prefer that we kind of maintain that versus more of a levy request in that fund.
Okay.
should.
Did you have a question?
I wanted to add, in the interest of transparency then, we're holding the hearing. It's not because we have to, it's because we want to have a very transparent
correct.
Budgetary and process.
That's correct. That is correct.
And I'm sorry, someone else? Anyone else have a question?
Carol, let me just say that I look forward to this memo every year like the new James Bond movie.
Oh, isn't that sweet, Carol?
No, thank you, Josh.
Kind.
You know, amidst the COVID, I did add some tidbits related to the pandemic, and so it's a little bit different this year, but it's
I noticed. I noticed.
Good.
Never talked about my memos like that, just so you know.
I will say, Carol, the more times I read it, the more sense it all makes. So I'm 80% of the way.
Good, that's good. It is a very confusing process.
But this was a real good explanation.
Good.
Really, really helpful. Okay, any other questions on this? Okay, if there is nothing more, we will then move on to the discussion on recommendation for health insurance renewal. And Carol, again, will lead this discussion.
Yes. We have been with Poderma Health since 2006. And basically, when we signed up, it's a three-year commitment that every 3 years we have to renew that commitment or have the ability to leave. And in July, we renewed that commitment with Poderma Health for another 3 years. We've been very happy being a part of the pool. We have 34 employees and less than 65 actual lives, but we are part of the pool, which is over 2,200 employees and almost 4,000 lives. So by being in a bigger pool, it allows us to get much better rates related to our insurance coverages. But every year we like to take a look at the plans that we offer, and Poderma did approve at the Health Council meeting the approval of the increase, which for the major cost expenditures is a 2.1 increase for the PPO plan and a 3%, I'm going to say a 3% increase in the HMO plan. Poderma allows us to have three options, and again, I think that's fared very well for us to give the options, because with further education, we've had a shift from employees being in the traditional PPO, which there's a higher premium cost, first to the HMO program, and then to most recently the HRA, or it's a high deductible plan with an HRA. So we have a $1,250 deductible plan and then a health reimbursement account for $1,000. And five employees actually went to that last year. So I think providing options for employees based on their medical care and whether they like to be in network, out of network, and have the option to go out of network without being penalized has been very helpful. And I think our staff has been very pleased with our insurance plan. I have outlined in the memo, again, kind of the changes that Poderma has made with some of the coverage types, and adding some limitations on some of the specialty drugs for the prescription plan. But staff is proposing, and again, because we need to provide the plan selection to Poderma, would ask for approval of the recommendation listed in the packet, which was specifically on page 16 of your packet, to approve the three plan options, to approve a slight increase in contribution levels for all employees at the percentages of, typically we like to guide towards 10% of the dependent costs, and also to use $2,000 of our medical reserve. I will also add that Poderma has approved giving back $1 million of the net position of two member agencies. So it's based on the number of years we've been in the Poderma Health program, And I don't know the exact amount just yet, but that will be something that they are returning to member agencies, kind of like they did on the property casualty side. They gave us 10% back on our premiums. And so they're planning to do this as well for the health side of it, which we would then put right back into the medical reserve and use for future taxing, for future premium increases. So I don't know if anybody has any questions on the memo that was provided in the packet.
Just a quick question.
Yes.
These rate of increase is actually decreased than in previous years, isn't that right?
Pardon?
The rate of increase is less than in previous years?
Yes. The last 2 years, I think it was 4%. Last year, 2.17%. 19, a little over 4% in 18. There was a 0% increase in 2017. I was hoping for that, but amidst the COVID pandemic, too, I wasn't really sure what to expect this year. And again, we've been very happy with Paterna Health and being a part of their wellness program. So I think it's been a positive thing for staff.
Okay.
Carol,
yeah.
Just out of curiosity, why isn't the rate for the single folks going up? Why is it just going up for anybody who has children and families?
Because the dependent coverage or the premium cost, we typically have allowed probably around a 3-5% cost for employees only. If they only pick that, dependent cost adds a lot more cost to our program.
Right, but isn't the cost, I'm just surprised that, you know, it's gone about 2-3% depending upon, you know, if you have a family and not, I'm surprised that you would have just streamlined that out of the singles. Not a big deal, just curious.
Yeah, actually, Paterna did, as a part of their changes this year, they switched the administrative fee to, used to just be a flat fee across all coverages, and this year they are heavily more weighting on the dependent coverages, so there was a higher increase in the premium related to those coverages, so it might look a little bit skewed from the previous year, but we've always kept the employee-only coverage minimal. If someone has the option to have their spouse covered on another plan, we definitely want to have them do that.
Yeah, we charge a premium for that, by the way. Your spouse is eligible and your spouse goes on our plan, we charge a premium.
Yeah, we've discussed that.
Mm. Only if your spouse is eligible. If your spouse is not eligible, then no premium. Yeah, I would just think that, you know, I can see some people with families saying, you know, why does mine keep going up and up and up, and if your single doesn't, but.
Well, theirs cost probably 3 times what a single person is, so.
Yeah.
It would be nice if we could, but again, I think the cost is definitely on the dependent side.
Yeah.
And just to pick up on what Michael said, Carol, you said you've discussed that idea, that possibility. You tabled it until maybe next year?
Yeah, I think just with everything with COVID and impact to employees, we kind of just...
It's not a good year.
Yeah, not a good year to make that change.
Okay, got it. Anyone else regarding the health plan?
Just clarify that second chart that's in here, the 2020 versus 2021. Are those the rates we pay, or that's just like a general chart? Like
what? No, that is the actual rates paid.
That the park district pays for all
employees. Correct.
All right. Okay, there we go. Anything else regarding the health plan? Then we will move on to the discussion on Watts Ice Rink operations amidst COVID-19. And this will be Lisa Shepherd, Bobby, and Adam leading the discussion.
Actually, I don't know if you all know Adam. Adam's our facility manager, so he's in charge of Watts and Watts operations. So I can tell you that the entire team has much discussion on Watts operations this year because it does have to change. But I'm going to throw it to Adam to give the presentation.
Thanks, Lisa. So we're going to take you through a little bit related to the operational plan. But first, we wanted to start with just a look at what the current state guidelines are related to outdoor recreation. So outdoor recreation facilities should limit group sizes to 50 patients or fewer. Multiple groups of 50 are permitted at once, as long as facilities allow for social distancing of customers and employees, 30 feet between groups, and areas for each group are clearly marked to discourage interaction. So with that being said, we can have multiple groups of 50. So we could have a group of 50 on the main, and then based off of size of the studio, we could have another group of 25 probably or fewer on the studio break. Our interpretation is that masks are required for all patrons in the facility. So even just ice skating during public skate, that is our interpretation. We are going to get further guidance on that. And then BCO sports guidelines for mask wearing say that when exercising outdoors, participants should wear face coverings over their nose and mouth whenever not actively exercising or participating in practices or competition. So based off of what our interpretation is for a hockey or a skating class, they could theoretically not have a mask on while actively participating since we are outdoors. So just a little bit of background on the lot season. So our normal season runs the day after Thanksgiving through the end of February, weather permitting. Last couple years we've stayed open longer. 2020-21 tentative dates would be November 27th through February 28th. Our typical usage groups in the facility include public skate, open hockey, permanent renters, skating classes, and then your party and hockey rentals. A little bit of past and season information. So historically, we've sold on average about 300 passes a year. Last year, we had 303 sold with 1,269 pass a visit for an average pass visit of about 4.2. Based off of some of our proposed fees, kind of the break-even point would be 5 visits this year based off of a $50 pass fee for a resident or a non-resident. Some general information related to the season would be 94 days or 14 weekends and 28 weekend days. Last year, our average skate, for public skate, we averaged 92 people coming between 1:30 and 4:30 on Saturdays, and on Sundays, 146. So that's on average on our busiest days during the season, our Saturdays and Sundays. So here's some of our proposed rates in comparison to last year. From a pass standpoint, we have several different models. But this year, we're actually proposing to have one single rate across all passes. So we've typically had an individual rate, and then each additional family member would pay less fee. In order for simplicity with COVID, we are recommending doing one flat fee of $50. So there is a drop down, but for a family of four, it would actually be $200 for a family of four, and then $191 last year for a family of four. The biggest change is that we're recommending doing a non-resident rate for the first time. That way we're giving preferential treatment to our residents and having an upcharge for those non-residents. So we're recommending a 50% markup over the resident passes for this year. We're also looking at recommending doing guest passes similar to the beach model. So 5 visits for $50 or $75, so it'd be $10 or $15. We've also typically done a combo pass for hockey, or we've done, which allows them to either skate or play hockey, and then we also do a 10 punch card. We're just going to, our recommendation is to do a hockey only pass or a skating only pass. So if you did a combo pass, it would be $200 versus the $185 in 2019-20. And then a comparison for our ice rental rates, we are recommending a 20% increase over last year's rental rates and actually increasing the non-resident rate from a 10% markup to a 25% markup. So we'll go from 284 to 344 for the main rink, and then 170 to 206 for the smaller studio.
Hey, Adam?
Yep.
When I saw this, all these prices, I thought to myself, wow, going up quite a bit. Is there a way to offset some of these increases, at least with the easiest way to do it, the main ice and the studio ice, and maybe have
lower prices on, you know, Monday through Thursday and higher prices Friday, Saturday, Sunday? Or is it, I mean, I'm just thinking of, you know, renting out the ice on a Saturday night or Saturday afternoon is a lot more demand than during the week. And I'd love to, like, see if we can offer, you know, after school cheaper for those that, you know, can shift their time a little bit.
Right. So our recommendation is to kind of follow suit with the pass only model. Just due to the limited capacity of the rink, it's really difficult for us to differentiate between pass holders and.
Oh, sorry. Not for the pass holders. I'm talking about just the renting the ice.
Oh, you're meaning having higher or lower rates. And we don't historically have a lot of open rental ice during the weekdays.
Perfect. Maybe quite a bit. Maybe we'll bounce up some tonight.
Right. It's something we can certainly look into. We just typically don't have a lot of rental availability. A lot of our permanent renters will play at night. We have the Winnetka Hockeys,
yeah.
Northbrooks. But certainly
I think you guys are saying the opposite thing. I understand what you're saying to say we don't have any available slots open to rent, so why would we lower the prices?
That's correct. Yeah, they're usually all booked up. Yeah.
During the week.
Correct.
Adam, how do these rates compare to our neighboring communities for the ice rental?
Absolutely. So I've been talking with Tom Golan from Winnetka Hockey, Northbrook. They're paying at North Shore Ice, they're paying $4.70 an hour. And then in Buffalo Grove, they're paying almost $600 an hour for ice.
Which are indoors, right?
Correct.
I mean, it's very hard to compare watts to anything else.
Well, I think the demand for watts is going to be more this year because it is one of the two out centers, but I don't think we should lower our rental because they are already almost sold out. And during the week, we try to maximize it for our season pass holders, so we have the demand there, so I think we should keep the prices where they are or what we're recommending.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to them for the weekend. I was just trying to think of, you know, I know I've been to watts where there is less activity during the week. I'm sure, you know, the season could be different. I'm just trying to think about, you know, I don't see a bunch of people wanting to drop $350 for an hour of ice on a Tuesday afternoon, but maybe someone's willing to do it for $100 when the thing's not used or $200 when the thing's not used and sees it as a deal. That was my only thought, but I don't have the schedule in front of me, so I don't quite frankly know. It's more just to have that thought.
There are some rinks that do some pricing adjustments if it's still open less than, you know, 48 hours in advance or something like that. It's something like I know North Shore does and so forth. So something we can look into. Historically, we don't have a lot of main ice availability in general during the season. Yep. But we do have those really, really fast.
Yep, if you're booked, you're booked.
To the rates. Aren't we facing some major capital improvements that are needed that we want to try to support?
Yeah. Yes. And part of the other reason we are looking at increasing rates to where they are is, you know, we're anticipating having less daily admission coming in or minimal pass sales. We're going to be limited with the capacity so much. One way to offset some of that loss is by increasing our rates even more from the rental standpoint.
And I'm sorry, Adam, were you finished with your presentation or would you like to continue and then we'll
ask
questions?
Okay. Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Here's some budgeted financials just so you can kind of see how the breakdown of where our revenue comes in for the rink. So bulk of it is through our ice rentals. The hockey rentals, the majority of those are permanent renters. Between Winnetka, Northbrook, and some of our regular groups. And then we typically do about 15 to 20, depending on the weather and the season, through parties. Daily admission, again, flows based off of the weather of the season. We're planning between public skate and open hockey for about 32,000. Pass sales for about 300 passes per year amounts to about 15,000 in our skating classes. Which don't technically come out of the Watts budget, but are about $13,000 in revenue on average. There could be a sizable increase there, given not a lot to do in the winter, and these are outdoor ice classes. Some operational differences that we're recommending due to the capacity limits, it's going to severely affect our ability to allow people out on the ice. So comparing capacity limits 2019, 50 on the main studio compared to 250 on the studio. Our recommendation, all guests must have a pass or be a guest on a guest pass to access the facility to capacity limits. In the past, if you're a non-skater, we haven't always charged you daily admission. If you're just hanging out in the building. Dedicated time slots for public skate and open hockey. We've had no limited time slots in that sense where only so many people can be out on the ice. We are planning to add additional dedicated family skate nights every Friday. Some of them will be themed, but those will be every Friday night until 7:30, 8 o'clock, which historically has been a lot of party rentals that we'll do on the evenings on Fridays. So we are adding that and along with team skates and so forth. And then the biggest difference is the access to the building or locker rooms. We're not planning to have access. We'll only have external bathrooms only due to our e-learning care program that's operating in the lobby and in the building. So our staff recommendation for an operation, so limited capacity is driving really this decision. Or recommendation. Option number one is passes only with limited guest passes. Control who has priority for the public skate or open hockey. It's passes only or guest passes. That allows us to control the priority for pass holders. Reservations will be recommended. Planning to utilize Eventbrite for reservations. Option two is to do more of our normal season of passes and daily admission. Problem is it's unable to control the priority for public skate or open hockey, or still reservations are going to be recommended. But first come, first serve would be an option. It must purchase a new module, though, to allow for an advanced purchasing or find an alternative method. Some facility improvements that we're looking at. I don't know if, Chris, you want to talk about some of these?
Yeah. I'm sorry, could I get a clarification on the last slide?
Yep.
Is what you're saying with respect to option two that you don't recommend it because if it's a 27 degree sunny day, you could have hundreds of people showing up trying to purchase a daily admission, and then not only many of them, but also the people that's purchase passes wouldn't be able to get in because of the capacity limit?
Correct. It would be really challenging to control that, at least especially on the weekends when we get 200 people. I mean, opening day, we get 500 plus people coming through. So it'd be really difficult if we don't have the passes only option with guest passes. It allows us to control who can actually enter the facility, similar to what we did with the beach, to be able to control that.
Yeah, so while admitting that there isn't 100% overlap between the beach patrons and the Watts patrons, there is at least a precedent here that worked pretty well. Is that correct? That's pretty parallel to what we did on the beach, correct?
Correct. So,
thanks for clarifying.
Any other questions related to that?
Just on the reservation. So obviously, you know, you'll have people who sign up and don't show up, and then that takes one of the 50 spots. So how often will that be updating? You know, for people who are looking for an opening, because that, you know, unfortunately people will do that.
Yeah. So we will plan to not open it up more than probably 3 or 4 days in advance, just so that you don't get people reserving it 2 weeks out and then changing plans or the weather stinks or whatever it might be, or just don't want to come to the rink. So we're going to have to monitor that really close. It's not going to be a perfect solution, unfortunately. We've seen it a little bit in the fitness center already. People reserve time slots. They won't turn up. Luckily, it hasn't been overly crowded yet. But it'll be a day of situation. We'll have to manage that. And I think utilizing our rain out line and communicating capacity will be something we'll have to really do a good job at.
Adam, correct me if I'm wrong, you could also set up a waiting list on there, and that way if someone is, say, if it's a 1 to 2:30 spot and someone doesn't show up, doesn't show up, we don't call off the waiting list. I grant that there would be less time for them to escape, we do that also.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you say the building is closed, and I'm sorry, you're probably going to get to this, but I didn't see it specifically in the packet, or I missed it. So are we doing rental skates, or we're not doing rentals at all?
We are planning to do rental skates.
Adam, I probably can break some of that down here, if you'd like.
Let's talk about the improvements, and then I might answer some of your questions, Stephanie.
I'm going to take your screen here for a second. Can everyone see this overhead of the Watts Ice Rink here?
Yep. Yes.
So one of the things we looked at was, if the facility is closed, how are you actually going to get in and out of Watts? And what's the most efficient way of still being able to serve the customer? So we really only have two very easy ways in the facility. You have here by the condenser, and you have this way here, which is the way we're currently using. We're entering the studio rink for deck hockey, which is what started us down this road. So what we're examining here and we're moving forward with is pouring a concrete pad here and basically making this our walkway into the facility with a gate. So inside the facility right here is our skate rental area. So staff is working on a plan to cut a hole in the side of the building with a mason and install a sliding glass window. So we'll have a cashier there. That cashier will be able to rent skates to customers. They'll be able to transition in and out of the building here. And then when they return their skates, we're looking at a chute or something of that nature where they can go and put them in through one of the existing windows, and then they can be sanitized and returned for the next customer. So some other things that were, is there any particular questions on that?
Where does everybody put their skates on?
Well, that's something that we're working on right now. We have this open area here which has rubber on it, so we're going to move some of the benches from the lobby out here. We're examining things like, you know, potentially temporary heaters, you know, all types of things of that nature. We're still kind of in the beginning of figuring out what's going to work for us, what heights we have to have on things. So we've got a pin in that right now, but our thought is that we're planning on staging participants in this area here.
So benches and such, so like inside but outside.
So with some hockey players, they will be coming dressed. We will be encouraging people to get hard rubber skate guards for those who own their own skates so they can walk in with their skates on. That's typically what's being done at most indoor ice rinks right now, is see a lot of kids getting dressed in the parking lot and in the back of the Jeep, things like that, and walking in with their hard skates on. That obviously won't work for folks who are using rental skates, but for the vast majority of our skaters, it will be okay.
So I'm blessed with a hockey kid, which is really expensive and frustrating and involves lots of getting dressed in the back of cars 4 days a week. I think having a, you know, some sort of tent, some sort of warmer is probably a great idea. Chris, can you explain to me, if you can zoom out a little bit, I can't imagine there is, you know, a high, well, I shouldn't say I can't imagine, because I'm sure there is. Is there ability to use the soccer field at all, which may be less in demand between December 1st and March 1st?
But yeah.
Put a tent up there and have people...
Well, unfortunately, the soccer field is out of use at this time based on the fact that the school district will be installing a geothermal energy system under the field. So we won't have access to that, to the majority of that field. The other thing that we're currently looking into right now and we're spending some time on is outdoor temporary structures are a little tricky because of snow loading.
Yep.
So you have to find something that kind of goes way beyond like an event tent for a wedding, because you might have 4 or 5 inches of snow on top of it.
Yep.
So it can be, not that I'm going to be the no person on this one, but it can be a little bit tricky to find something that fits within our needs and also isn't going to break the bank.
Yeah, no, I hear you on that. I'm just, you know, literally, you know, we go to these hockey things 3 or 4 days a week. That area between the small rink and the studio rink and the NHL rink is tight.
I mean, it's a small space, so I'm trying to figure out, you know,
it's about 18 feet wide.
It's what?
It's about 18 feet wide, and the length of the studio is a good 70 feet, so it's still going to be tight, to your point, if there's 40 people in there putting their gear on. I totally agree with you.
Yeah. It'd just be interesting to see if there's something we can think of either in front of the studio rink or at the soccer field out there.
I think that's something that we can definitely keep looking into.
Okay. And as for encouraging people to get dressed, I think most of the teams will do that because it is such a laborious task. And it's going to, like right now they do it and it's fine because it's 67 degrees. When it's 30 degrees, no one's going to want to change outside. So I think you'll see that. But my question is that, you know, I imagine the renters are the folks that are going to need a little bit more space, a little more time. You know, you could probably stagger that as well, right? The folks can probably see, hey, look, we've got, you know, we can only do 10 renter, we can only do 10 skates per hour or something like that to help that out. So I think you'll actually be okay. Sorry, that was more of a thought.
I think one of the things that's important to know right now is most indoor ice facilities are closed to parents. So the unique Wonderful. Thing about Watts will be that we'll actually give people the opportunity to watch their kids.
Yeah.
Which, Michael, I'm sure as you know, that's not really happening right now in indoor ice rinks.
Yeah.
So I think there is going to be Correct.
Yeah, right now there are no, it's coaches and kids only. Locker rooms are only open for goalies. They just have so much more to do.
Correct. So I think that that's going to really add to the premium here of the fact that people can actually, you know, observe their kids playing where they can't do that right now in the North facility.
Chris, do you tell them where people have to watch from if they...
Yeah, so right now you would be able to watch from here. This is all outside the facility. So you would not enter into the 50 participant capacity on this outside area here. It's all area that we do perform snow removal on, so it's not salted, but it's not terribly slippery. It's a good place to stand with a cup of coffee and watch the kids.
Maybe we can install the bleachers there that are at the soccer field over there.
Now you got your noodle going.
I do want to, I don't know if this is the right time, but I do want to come back and talk about Adam's proposal for I don't think I understand the no daily passes thing. I'm confused as to what that would apply to.
All right. Is there any more questions about entrance and exiting the facility, and I can turn it back over to Adam?
I just have a question about these improvements. What budget is that coming out of?
I would
come out of what?
Yeah. Is that coming out of our Fund 65 lease, Carol, or is that coming out of the Watts budget?
Carol,
you're muted.
I believe it's coming out of Watts, so I can circle back around.
Sorry, I was on mute. I would, Watts, I don't know if we could, it doesn't really matter where, I guess. The reality is it's coming out of our funds. I don't know the extent of the cost of these. So if they are to be at much higher cost, I would say Fund 65.
So it's not coming out of Fund 69.
Not Fund 69. It's either Fund 65 or Operational Watts Fund.
And obviously the time frame here is not extremely favorable. So are we confident that this work can get done? Like, what have been the discussions on that?
That's a good question. So what we've done is we've used the contractor who's currently doing the work at Duke Park. Mm-hmm. So we used the legally bid unit cost for sidewalk and worked with the contractor to get them to come and do this while we have them under contract for an $850,000 project, but we have a little leverage.
Yeah.
So that contractor is going to be doing the concrete work. We're also using the mason that does all of our repairs on the beach stairs, someone we have a pre-existing relationship with, to do the actual hole in the wall. And our building's facilities foreman, Bill Eldridge's first job was actually installing windows, lucky us. So Bill will be installing the window in-house. We've already got the window ordered from Lowe's. We're looking at a couple of other options as far as heaters go, what makes sense for our application, whether it's electric or propane. So again, it's going to be a commercial product. I I don't see the only real time crunch that we have is getting the concrete poured before it gets really cold.
I mean, when are we going to see the numbers on that? Because this sounds expensive. We don't have a lot of money there.
It's actually within my budget purview, so it would be under, I believe it's $20,000.
Yeah, the concrete itself is about $5,000, and the window, all said and done, will probably be about $2,200. So not terrible in the sense of operating the facility.
It is worth noting that we did identify some savings on the operation of the facility too, and also those increases in rates for permanent renters and private ice rentals, as part of that was to cover those increased costs due to COVID and these facility improvements. So we're hoping those will cover those.
You know, I think your biggest challenge, everything you've said is like a, it's like, well, I guess the best solution to a terrible, terrible vexing problem.
Yeah.
But I think your biggest challenge is the messaging and the marketing and making sure people understand that the building will not be open if they need to use the bathroom. It'll be an outside facility, which is an additional operational cost or whatever, and that they should come in their skates, and then maybe we can sell the skate protectors on the side as a little, like, oh, we can't do that? I would love to do that. Anyway, something like that. It's really about the messaging and getting people so that they don't, they're not disappointed that they can't buy a daily pass because we must have a season pass. We know how challenging that was with the beach. And so that's, you know, I think that's the big, big hurdle in front of you. Anyway, go ahead. You were going to jump back to Adam and the previous a question about the daily passes.
Actually, before
Adam, we put up the slide again for the daily fees.
I was not under the impression that bathrooms going to be used. I know if you're a parent and you're outside of North Shore Ice Area, if you use the bathroom, they let you in. Are we really not letting people one at a time use the bathroom?
The external bathrooms on the front of the building that are open during the summer, we'll have those open for use.
They're not a porta potty.
Oh!
You cannot have a porta potty back with me.
Hold on a second. There's a bathroom on the outside of the box building, and you go off the front walkway. It's a heated indoor bathroom. Chris is pointing to it now. Those will be used for.
That's great.
So it's not a porta potty, it's outdoor. It's a, you know, bathroom inside a building that's heated.
Additional operating expenses made me nervous. I also would, for the record, I think you can let people use the other bathroom. To me, having one or two people in to use the men's room or the women's room in Watts, I could see someone taking a long time at that bathroom, and to me it seems like unnecessarily onerous to close down the indoor bathrooms.
I have to respectfully disagree with you. As a parent of two kids in that aftercare program, I would not be happy about that, and I assume other
people. As long as there's no kids in the building, like on the weekends, I hear you with there's kids in the buildings, but to me, if they're unused, I think it's.
But with the number of people that we're allowing, having two bathrooms available seems reasonable. Yes. Right?
Well, no, because it's not
such a reduced number of people. And once that you get into the building, you're now in the building. And there's really nobody in there to watch you. Right? And that's been a problem anyway with kids up to no good in those bathrooms. I don't know.
We don't want to allow anybody in there because all the costs associated with letting even one person in there into that program, because the kids that come to that program are in pods. If we let one person in there, then we have to do the whole cleaning protocol for the whole building. So not only do we have the expense of the staff member that would have to be in the building to observe it, we also have the expense of cleaning costs for that to happen. So that's why we're not recommending it because of that essential care program.
Sorry, I agree with you guys. I think we may be talking apples and oranges here. I agree with you. If there are kids inside that building and there's an after-school program, I get it. I think on the weekends when the facility is dedicated more to open skate or open hockey, I feel like
you know, we have to have some, like, we had more than one person in the bathroom in the beach house. It's okay to let people in a bathroom, I think. But
yeah, but that just, it was already open. This just already was closed. You'd have to staff it. You'd have to have people in there. I mean, there's two bathrooms outside for 50 people.
Stephanie, it's not 50 people because it's 50 people who are watching hockey or who are playing. It's parents. If you're going to have people standing around, they're going to use the bathroom. It could be more than that.
You're playing hockey, you're not using the bathroom at the same time.
Right. I will interject. I think it's a logistical impossibility to have the skating rinks open on the weekend and then have to completely clean the facility before school starts on Monday. That cleaning would have to happen after the last skaters were there if we left those rinks open. So we'd have to have janitors in Sunday night. And I just think it would logistically be, I just don't think it's necessary. But on that point, maybe if we start having a terrible kerfuffle about bathroom use, we would reconsider it. But I just think it would be onerous to have to sanitize the building because we've left it open for the bathroom. And I also think we have a problem with monitoring people once we get in the building. In any case, shall we move along to Michael?
Do we want to answer the question?
Yeah. I don't understand what this means for. So you're saying for open skate and open hockey, you have to have a season pass, or you can,
correct?
Or a 10 punch or something, or it has to be a season pass?
A season pass, and then you can come as a guest of a pass holder, just like we did at the beach.
I'm okay being an outlier here. I don't love this solution. I think there are people who may want to skate once or twice a year, and may not have a friend that does it. Most probably will have a friend, but to me, I don't love this. I like the idea of being able to make a reservation, or at least selling a 3-pass instead of a 10-pass or something that lets people have more access to this awesome facility. I'd love to see if that's a possibility. I hear you guys, and I understand that this is a different year, and we have a lot of different protocols out there. But to me, I still don't feel great about how we turned away so many people from the beach last season. And I know our residents loved it, and our residents voted us in. To me, that it just didn't feel right.
Our biggest holdup, Michael, is that obviously we don't like to do this either. We want as many people in the way walk like they always have. And this is a different time. Our problem is what if we sell 400 passes and then these 400 people go to reserve a time on, say, a Saturday or Sunday or after school or Friday night with this event, and all of a sudden they can't get spots. So they put their money up front. And then they can't get, you know, they can only get time once or twice. Then we get all the repercussions of that. So we thought it was a good solution to do the limited guest passes so that people can bring them in. And we understand that there might be a few people that only want to skate once or twice. We're hoping, just like the beach, that they end up buying a pass for the cheap cost of $50 and use it like 4.2 times to break even, or 5 times. Over how many options they have, which I believe was 98. Maybe it's more than that. We think that's a pretty good deal, you know, to do that. So, we just don't know any other way to, because if we get that 300 to 500 people and all of a sudden everybody's knocked out, and most of those people that get knocked out are residents, then we think we have an even bigger problem on our hands. We don't like it either, but this is our only solution that we can think of.
Yeah, I think I'll just have to disagree with you guys on this. I just don't love this answer. And I think we can probably think harder about other ways. Either limited, with a reservation, you know, stuff like that. I feel like even at the beach when I saw there were people being turned away on gray sky days, it just didn't feel right to me. I feel like we can make an effort to make these things more accessible to the citizens. But again, I think differently than you guys, and I get that.
I guess my concern is how you're going to manage. I was never one of these moms. I was didn't have my act together the right way, but a lot of people are going to have it scheduled. The minute that opens, they're going to reserve the spot, whether they really plan on bringing their kid or not. How will you, that was not an issue with the beach, but it would be an issue with water. Have you thought about how you, kind of talk us through what you've considered, like if you're going to slot it for half hour chunks of time, and how much time do they have before you say, okay, that's it, you can't come in, we're letting someone else in. Like, how are you going to manage that?
Yeah, I mean, I think look, it's the world that we live in now. Epic Vail Resorts is doing something very similar, where they're giving priority to people who want to do it. If Adam, if what you're saying is that you'd open this up 3 or 4 days in advance because it may be a different weather day, you know, you open up 3 or 4 days in advance to season pass holders, and then 48 hours in advance to others. There are ways to do this. There are companies out there that have, like Eventbrite could probably do this for us. Give season pass holders the first lick, and if not, let's fill it up with people who want to use it that didn't. And so it's kind of a win-win.
Michael, I hear what you're saying, but I don't see it the same way. If I purchased a season pass and then I decided on Saturday that I wanted to go to Open Skate, mm-hmm. and I could not go because a whole bunch of people bought last-minute day passes in the 72 hours before.
No, I'm not saying 72. Like, you're going to open it up for everybody, 72 or 96. You cut the time in half. This is exactly what Vail, all the ski resorts are doing this year as well. So I think there's a market that works for it. Again, we can disagree, but I think there's a market an established marketplace that works well for this.
Well, then what happens, so you're still going to have people that show up that don't go online that say, I want a day pass, and you're still going to have to turn those people away because we're not going to be selling those at the facility because for the same reasons I imagine you guys went over, it's just, it's too hard to, you don't want to exchange money. We're going to be so enclosed in that space. I'm assuming that was your thought process there.
Yeah.
You're still
going to
have to turn people away.
Oh, yeah. I think the thought of turning people away is something that we wrestled with at the beach. And we were like, oh, my gosh, we have 2,000 pass holders. We're going to turn some away at some point. We never did, which was nice. But I look at these numbers on, your daily admission was your second highest source of revenue from your budget of financials. There are days where there is underutilized asset and opportunities that work in the marketplace that have this exact same problem that we have, and they've overcome it. And I think that while it may be too hard, I think we're better than that, and we can do it. But again,
it's nothing to do with being too hard. That's not why we're making this recommendation. If we thought there's a way that we could be fair to our pass holders, we would do it. So it's not about being hard. It's just about the value of a season pass would be completely diluted if we let dailies in. And so it's almost like don't do season passes then, and then only do daily as first come, first serve. You know, there's really, but we'd rather capture the guaranteed revenue of a season pass. So it's not that it's too hard or we haven't thought about all these ideas. It's more that we really feel that people are going to get a value of the season pass. We will have more people upset with us if they are kicked out from a daily admission point. I mean, it's not ideal. It's totally different than the beach. The beach, we could take 800 people. This, we can only take 75 people at one time. So that's a much smaller concentration. Bobby, do you
have anything to add? But just very quickly, one of your biggest problems might be a ton of people buying, I mean, $50 for a pass for your kid, knowing they could be out and getting some fresh air in this horrible upcoming winter. Kind of seems like a good deal, and you might just start selling a ton of season passes and have a whole different problem.
I am afraid
just
of that.
Just like we did for the beach. It's very possible, yeah. It will, but at least I think people could swallow it better that they're all season pass holders going for those times and then all of a sudden dailies came in. Because we have a feeling that we're going to get a lot of people from other neighboring communities coming in because this is one of the only games in town.
Yeah.
Well, we do know Highland Park. cancels all public skate for the year. So there's no public skate happening at that rink of the Centennial. Adam, I think it's worth just mentioning how we've changed the time structures for public skate to smaller slots so that we, you know, we are expecting multiple hundreds of people on a Saturday and Sunday, how we're going to accommodate our pass holders during those.
Yeah. Lisa, officially, so Brooks, this might answer your question, I think. But we, historically, we ran public skate, first come, first serve, passes our daily admission on Saturdays and Sundays from more or less 1:30 to 4:30. This year, we're actually shuffling around some of our permanent renters a little bit that skate on weekends to accommodate additional open skate time on the weekends. We're actually going to do 3 hour-and-a-half or 90-minute time slots on Saturdays and Sundays starting at 11 a.m. So the hour-and-a-half would be your time in the facility, kind of like what we did with the fitness center. You can enter in as of 11 a.m. You have to be out by 12:30. Then we have a 30-minute break to be able to clear everybody out or make sure everybody's out, get reset, get skates cleaned, et cetera. And then the next group would come in then at, say, 1 o'clock at the next time slot, have another hour and a half, another 50 people. And then we'd actually have a third time slot as well from 3 to 4:30. So we'd realistically be able to accommodate 150, which based off of our average visit last year, we're under that. We're above that, and our average was below.
Has there been any discussion on if it's, like, completely crazy and you sell, like, way more than you ever did of any kind of maximum cutoff point like we had to the beach?
Yeah, there has been a discussion about that, and, you know, we're going to – we have a communication plan that Aaron can go into a little bit more detail about to really get the information, the lessons learned from the beach, and how we communicate that effectively. We do expect a lot of pass sales. We really do. So that's why we've added those additional time slots. And we think there may be additional demand during the weekdays when traditionally we haven't seen a large attendance. So there's a significant after school time, Adam, what is it, 3 to 5?
3 to 5:15, something like that.
So we've added additional public skate times to try to take that extra demand for ice time.
That seems reasonable.
And
Aaron, you want to talk a little bit about our communication, how we're going to communicate this to our residents? Absolutely. Like Brooke's point, we know communication is a big part of this.
Absolutely. So we're going to look at two different direct mail pieces. One being at Funco, which goes to every resident. And then the second would be a little bit later, an oversized postcard that links to our website for the QR code. We do think QR codes now, since people are going to use them at restaurants and stuff, will be useful and trackable. We're also going to do outdoor banners on site. We're really looking at the facility signage to make sure everything's clear. Where you can enter and exit, as well as customers only. We're going to use email, social media, promoter posts, update the website, of course. And then working with the local media to make sure the story gets out. Any questions?
I think this is different, too, because we had more of a limit kind of with resident, non-resident. This is open to everyone. Everyone will have the same chance to buy that pass. So it is different.
Yeah. And I would like to note that in the past we have never charged a non-resident rate, but because of the demand this year, that's why we definitely added a non-resident increase for the first time.
Yeah, and it makes sense. I mean, residents are supporting Watts, obviously, with the taxes, and they should get a little bit of a break on the fee. Every facility everywhere else certainly has resident non-resident rates, so it's moving in the right direction. I don't feel badly about that.
I agree with that.
Well, are we all tapped out on our skating, or are there any more questions?
I I have a question about the masks and whether we require people to wear them or not. Perhaps Adam could pull up that slide again.
So
the state guidelines, we are going to get some guidance from corporate counsel to make sure we're interpreting it correctly, but masks are required for any outdoor recreation, according to the DCEO guidelines. The only exception could be while actively participating in a youth sport or adult sport.
Yeah.
Right, so that seems like one truck-sized loophole.
Lots of problems, Josh, because
our world.
Most hockey teams practice in different rinks, and my daughter, like one of them, I think it's Glenview, requires that you have a mask on the rink, and I think it's the only one in the area that does. North Shore Ice Arena and Winnetka do not require it, and so there's a lot of chatter there. I think, you know, you could go either way on this one. And still not be wrong, but I think it's good to bring it up because there's a lot of different philosophies here. And quite frankly, there's even on our own hockey, our my own kids' hockey team, there are some parents who are like, why is everyone wearing a mask? And there's some parents who are like, why wear a mask on the thing?
So okay, but I think that's a helpful context, Michael. But just as a commissioner, let me share my opinion about what I'm comfortable with and. The rest of you can comment and we can make a decision or leave it in staff's hands. But I ran by a group of kids playing basketball at Watts, not at Watts, at Call Park the other day. I hope that wasn't a Park District sponsored event. It gave me the heebie-jeebies. There were 20 kids playing basketball with no masks, coaches with masks pulled down under their noses, and dads standing shoulder to shoulder drinking coffee with no masks on. And
what was that? That wasn't our program.
Thank you for saying that. I'm glad that's true, not just for you saying that. I guess the reason I have some doubt about this is that it's not clear to me that a hockey rink with glass wall around it is outdoors. Certainly you can make an argument that it is, but it's also kind of not the same thing as standing, you know, in an open field. And particularly if you're playing a contact sport, it worries me, and I would feel more comfortable if people wearing
this. Okay. Mrs. Dudley, I too feel we're more comfortable with the masks as they do in print.
I don't necessarily know if staff wants us to weigh in, because I suspect you're going to make the decision based on what corporate counsel and probably best practice in this is going to lead you to. Is that safe to say?
Well, it's interesting because we'll be talking about basketball in a few minutes, and I believe we're required to have the youth basketball kids wear masks when they're inside the gym, correct?
Correct. Yeah. So the only point I would make is there is a lot of debate going on around ice rinks right now about this topic, and we are still 7 weeks away from opening the rink. We think there's going to be a little bit more guidance from the state, and obviously we're going to have to continue the dialogue and look what best practices are. That giant loophole that Josh pointed out is something that's been debated heavily. And we as staff are definitely looking what best practices are and talking with Federma corporate counsel on it. So I think we'll hopefully have a little bit more guidance here soon.
Yeah, I think that was what I was trying to allude to earlier, Josh, that there is, and quite frankly, I'd like to understand what Federma thinks as well. And I do imagine that come the next few weeks, there will be some more guidance to help us. But it is all over the place, and you know, parents, doctors, coaches all have, you know, different views. So I think it's good to ask. I'd love to see what Federma thinks about this one.
I guess I would point out, Lisa, let me just say one more thing.
Absolutely.
There's no black and white,
right?
Nobody's going to say that it's completely safe to play without a mask or, frankly, with a mask, right? Or to skate in a rink with or without a mask. Everybody's taking risks. And it's fundamentally about what is an acceptable level of risk. And I'm sure we'll get corporate counsel to some extent weigh in on it, but it's also a judgment call about, well, how much risk do we want to take?
All right. So we will now move on to our discussion on youth basketball operations amidst COVID. And this is going to begin probably Adam or is this Bobby?
Shannon Stevens, our athletic supervisor.
Shannon. Oh, I didn't see your name there. Shannon, take it away.
Well, I'll let you start.
Sure. So we're going to just go through our recommendation and plans for the 2020-21 basketball season. Again, we'll start with state guidelines and our interpretation of it. Indoor recreation facilities should limit group sizes to 50 patrons or fewer. Basketball, and if you don't know this, the state did classify all sports into different levels of risk, so low, medium, or high risk. Hockey fell into that high risk. Basketball falls into a medium risk sport, which then each sport or risk level has four levels determining what they're able to do. So the green ones are what basketball is, level ones and level two. Level one allows for no contact practices and trainings only. Level two allows for intra-team scrimmages with parent consent for minors. So we can do intra-team scrimmages. Level three then goes on to intra-conference or EMS region, and then low-risk sports only for state or league championships. Level four is tournament out-of-conference play, no real limitations on that end. Masks are required for all patients entering the facility. In the DCO sport guidelines for mask wearing, when exercising indoors, face covering should be worn at all times, including while exercising or participating in practices or competition. So we will require them to wear masks to play basketball. I'll turn it over to Shannon for the next little bit.
We just want to start by giving a brief overview of what the 2019-2020 basketball season looked like. We started with preseason clinics for grades 1-6. Those clinics ran from October to November, and they were all held out of Taken. It was only on the weekend, or on the weekdays, excuse me, and it was all ran by our Glencoe Park District coaching staff. Following the preseason clinics, we had the House League, which ran from December to March, which ran for grades 1-6 as well. We used TAKIF West and Central for practice locations. TAKIF was the hub for grades 1 and 2. West housed 3rd and 4th grade practices, and Central housed 5th and 6th. Our coaches taught the clinics over here at TAKIF, and then volunteer coaches taught the practices over at the schools. House League also included a Saturday game day, which teams would come in and all the volunteer coaches would pretty much run that with myself and our basketball game day supervisor. The other option we had for basketball was travel teams for grades 4-6. Their season ran from October through March. It was all located, or majority located out of Central, with overflow coming to TAKIF during night, at night and evenings. The season included weekday practices, leagues, and tournaments, and how teams were made is by tryouts. They had a preseason clinic and tryouts to, so travel has limited numbers as well. All of this was overseen owned by Hot Shot Sports, with myself and Adam helping coordinate kind of the administrative side of scheduling practices as well as facility for games. So this is a chart kind of to just briefly state upon what other districts around us are doing, and from taking from the guidelines as well as other surrounding communities, what the Glen Cove Park District, what we are recommending. So for three out of the five park districts are offering a house league. Wilmette and Winnetka have not released anything about their basketball program, so it's all to be determined. Though the Glen Cove Park District, with all this information, we recommend having a house league. Moving towards the travel teams, three out of the five are not offering travel teams. Due to the guideline limitations, you can't really play intra-league, so it's more in-house based in scrimmages. You can't compete. The Glen Cove Park District staff does recommend that we do not offer a travel team this year. For volunteer coaches, two out of the five are utilizing volunteer coaches. The Park District of Highland Park is using their hired staff to coach the teams as well as facilitate the games. And Deerfield Park District, as well as Vernon Hills Park District, they are using volunteer coaches to lead practices as well as facilitate scrimmages. We recommend not having volunteer coaches due to the limitations in the gym, as well as just things we've seen throughout the summer. And as Josh pointed out, over at the basketball, it's hard. We do recommend bringing our in-house coaches who are COVID, they are familiar with our COVID guidelines already, and we know we'll implement these, our safety precautions. Moving forward, we also recommend no referees. Every park district I've reached out to are not bringing in referees for these games since they are non-competitive, and the coaches can easily facilitate these. For clinics and practices, most park districts, well, all of them, three out of five, are having a clinic, either an add-on four-week clinic or a clinic prior to the scrimmage. So we do recommend offering clinics slash practices. So separate registration. In years past, we've had one big registration for Health League, which included the game day as well as your clinic. This year, we decided, due to the COVID guidelines and having to have parental consent for scrimmaging, to separate out the game day. So a participant can only participate in clinics or only participate in game day, and if they want to do both, they can. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Based on all of this information, we do recommend, again, we only offer a health food type program compared to a travel. This is just a year-to-year comparison, so this will highlight the major changes between last year to this year. Last year, we utilized volunteer coaches to help facilitate practices, day practices, as well as the games. This year, we are recommending using our in-house coaches to run all weekday clinics, as well as facilitate the games. We will continue offering the weekday clinics, but except we will expand it for grades 3-6 as well. Saturday games last year were in a league format where each team got a schedule at the beginning of the year and they met their opponent every week, which led them to a playoff. This year, there will be no games. It'll be scrimmaging within pods, so it'll be the same 16 kids each week. The coaches will do skills and drills and then break them up into teams to scrimmage at the end. Last year, we did allow spectators in the game. This year, due to limited capacities in the gym and all of that, we are recommending no spectators. If you have 16 kids per side, it adds up really fast, as well as the four coaches and then myself and our gym supervisor to help clean. So the number and the capacity goes very fast. Last year, we tracked scores for standings. This year, since it's non-competitive, we will not be having a scoreboard or records kept, kind of since it's non-competitive. Also, last year, the final big difference is skill evaluations of scrimmage team. They were in the same team each week. for the entire season last year, and this year we are recommending no skill evaluation to divide the teams, so it will be the same 16 kids each.
Just to give a little bit of background on some of the financials implications related to the House League and travel and basketball program. So the bulk of our participation is in the House League program. So last year our actuals were 217 enrolled in House versus 50 in travel basketball. So really at the end of the day, the bulk of the participation in the community comes in the way of House League, which is in line as closely as possible with what the guidelines allow us to do, which is inter-team play, as Shannon alluded to, having those pods where they can scrimmage on a weekly basis and really be focused on that skill-based, learning how to play the game, dribble the ball, shoot, pass, et cetera, is really what we want to focus on, and getting as many people participating or kids participating in the community as possible.
So, based on our interpretations of the state guidelines for youth basketball and what our neighboring districts are doing, we recommend a House League-based program that focuses on skill development, on scrimmaging pods, and the House League will run for grades 1 through 6, with the ability to expand for 7 to 8th grade if there is a demand. And I would like to open up the floor for any questions now.
I just have one question. I think you did a great job presenting, by the way. Thank you, Shannon. Looks like you guys did, like with Watts as well, very comprehensive. Somebody who just celebrated some lovely religious holidays in a very unique way over Facebook Live, is there an opportunity to stream these games for the parents at all? Because I think you're right. I think having teams in there adds up real quickly. But I can see parents not wanting to do it because they can't see anything, and it could just be a really easy. We can use the camera that caught the. We can use the camera that was on the, you know, the sidewalk. Maybe set that up for Facebook Live and stream. I'm thinking low cost here, Josh. I don't want to add more cost on it.
It's a wildlife camera.
Yeah, put the wildlife camera.
So that we have gone back and forth about streaming, and it's just kind of the thought of who's going to man it each week, who, you know, my game day supervisor, he's not very tech savvy, so it's kind of who's going to run it, do we have connection in there, what will we connect it to, and then do we want that really on Facebook for a huge crowd to see and just kind of flood the feed. So I, yeah.
All things to think about, but I not love, I'm glad that you guys have thought about it. My thought was just sticking a camera in the corner and, you know, it's not going to move, it's not going to be banned, but if people want to see some of the game, they can see some of the game. I actually think you'll get more parents to sign up if that was an opportunity. Otherwise, it looks really comprehensive and nice about the community.
Thank you.
Yeah, we are going to look at that. We would have to set up two cameras because we usually have two cords going at a time. So we're going to look into the cost of what that it would cost to do that. And then staffing, you know, maybe we could find high school, college kids that would do that. We want to or volunteer, but volunteer would have to commit every week. So we are looking into that possibility. We understand that parents would like to see that. So we'll look at the cost and may have to pass that cost on to parents, so it might be part of the program fee.
Hey, Shannon, food for thought. When my kids were in House League basketball, I would have paid extra if spectating was not allowed.
With your dad, I know.
Right? I will tell you.
I don't know what.
Yeah. I love not seeing hockey practice. To me, it is a game changer. I hear you, Doc. I concur. The basketball crowd just seems a little bit more, at least from the games I went to, they seem very
intense.
Passionate, yes.
Those basketball parents are intense.
Yeah.
Speaking of basketball mom.
Great, but this year we've all seen enough of our kids, so maybe
good point.
I have a question, and I think I have this clear. So everything you're recommending is is Geisinger Park District run? Correct?
Yes.
We should not have
correct.
It. Okay, that's good, because you guys just, you know, you follow the guidelines really well, and when I see other programs running, they just don't do it as well, so I think this is good, comforting for this kind of sport, because, you know, it's still, you're still interacting. I mean, there's still an inherent risk.
Yeah.
You guys did a good job with this. I think you made the right decision.
Any other questions?
I just have a real quick question, because it just jumped out at me as like, God, that's weird. The net for travel, because there were 50 participants, I'm not seeing the screen now, but 50 participants, it was like 34K revenue, and the net was between 4,000 and 5,000.
Yeah,
it's
the amount of work and effort that goes into running the travel programs with the amount of schedule changes, practices. Like, that doesn't even incorporate the amount of gym usage that they use. I mean, they're using upwards of 40 to 50 hours of gym usage per season per team.
Yeah.
So it really amounts to, we really end up losing money probably on the team, but all said and done.
Yeah. Well, I really hope this season you guys do such a good job of basketball. Just like Josh, I had two of my kids were in the basketball. It was phenomenal. The house league was fabulous. My husband was a coach. I have great memories. I think the change this year is going to be kind of mellowing, and may, you know, give a whole new group of kids a love for basketball. It may change things in a really good way, even if it's just 1 year. So, good luck.
Great. Totally. Yep.
Thank you. I'm excited.
All righty. If there are no more basketball questions, we will move on to our discussion on Cock Park Project Phase 2. This one is for Lisa Shepherd and Chris to lead the discussion.
All right. I'm going to throw this over to Chris also. I have a lot of talking tonight. I want him to first start out with what our goals are, things we want to achieve on this project first, and then he's going to take it away. So go ahead, Chris.
So we looked at developing the scope of this project with four goals in mind. First is to improve the usability of the park, so drainage, things like that. Making sure that we have safe access, that the park is safe to be used at all times, and eliminating some things that we saw as potentially hazardous. We really wanted to make sure that the park could be as efficiently operated as possible, so efficient operations are very important to us. And in that process, we wanted to also maximize the program space. So when we talk about the program space, we're talking about the area directly in front of the gazebo, the bricks, the grass, the basically the front lawn of Glencoe, that is the front of Cock Park, as well as the basketball park area. So after our last meeting, I went and worked on breaking out each particular area of the project, why we proposed including it in the project, and our justification for that. So first, proposed drainage. Obviously, we've talked about this in the past. The front of the park is very soggy. It holds a considerable amount of water. Now that we're faced with the change in climate and then, you know, 20 to 30 inches of rain that we're getting routinely in the spring, it's just taken us to a point that the park really isn't usable. We're not running special events there. We're not renting it. We've made this tremendous $375,000 investment in the park for the gazebo, the lights, the water, and we really can't even use the park. So what we've proposed is adding drainage. I broke out some of the costs in comparison. The area in front of the gazebo is about the same size as the developed infield at Berlin Field, for comparison's sake. So depending on the topography, we may see this number come down a little bit. We might be able to capture some of the existing depressions, high points, things like that. But for comparison's sake, putting the drainage in at Berlin was around $200,000. So just to kind of have an idea of where one size area compared to another size area, about the same size. We've also proposed some ambient lighting. In the original project, there were two existing light poles out on the site. Unfortunately, they had to be removed during the project because they posed a significant hazard based on the age of the poles.
prior to the park starting to flood routinely, the lack of lights was something that we were getting significant community feedback on. The fact that it's not really well lit by the street and there are a lot of commuters that pass through the park. So what we would be proposing is ambient lights. Two of them is what I have in the proposal. Something similar to what we did on the Take It Playground, an LED light, very tastefully done. Not something that, you know, we're expecting to light every square inch of the park, sports field lighting, nothing like that. Really something so somebody leaving the train station would feel comfortable walking through Park Park without having to get their cell phone out to light the way in front of them. As far as planting bed irrigation goes, one of the things that we looked at in kind of the phase one of the project was ensuring that the water was upgraded at the site. I'd like the board to consider putting in planting bed irrigation. We're currently spending around $7,200 to water the flowers per year in that park. It's about 7 to 10 hours a week for a couple of different staff. That includes filling the water truck, driving it to the site, watering the flowers, moving the truck around the site, tractor, whatever the case may be, and then moving on to another site. I think the payback is going to be pretty quick. For comparison's sake, we are installing an irrigation system as part of the grant project at the trailhead at Veterans Park, which is approximately the same size as what we have at Cock Park, and that's around $25,000. So I think we'll have a pretty quick payback on that, as opposed to, you know, sending somebody out there to water the flowers, you know, 5 or 6 days a week throughout the most of the season. So I think that the numbers are there. I mean, if you look at the lifespan of an irrigation system, you're looking at 18 years, something like that, 20 years if you really take good care of it. Over that time frame, we're looking at somewhere around $130,000 in staff hours, and that's not including cost increases, equipment replacement. It's really just looking at a snapshot in time of our staff right now. So that factors in two staff that are doing that. Again, minimum wage is going up. We're not able to water these beds for $89 an hour, $7 an hour, $4 an hour when they were originally planted. As far as the park masonry, if anybody's had an opportunity to look at it, that seat wall that's there is in pretty tough shape. The drinking fountain is actually broken off the wall. There's been some significant settling along one side of the wall. What we would be proposing is coming in, removing the plant material that's grown on the wall, power washing the wall, and tuck pointing it, which is similar to what we're doing across the street at Veterans Park as part of the IDOC project. That wall will be repaired. From the records I can tell, there's really been no maintenance done on that wall since the late 80s, early 90s, so we're coming up on about 25 or 30 years with just pressure washing, so I think it's time to take a little bit of a look at that. We highlighted out park planting and landscape. So one of the things that we have going on at Cock Park is we have a couple of areas that were originally landscaped by a volunteer garden club. So we've got some plantings that are really tough to maintain for us at the municipal level. And what I mean by that is we have planting beds that have many, many, many species of plant in them. So when you typically develop a planting bed in a park, you're picking three or four species. So when you're sending staff out there to weed, you're not sending somebody out who has to have a master's degree to tell what a weed is and what a flower. You're sending somebody out that says, okay, I pull the weeds in between the daylilies or the tulips, something of that nature. So these volunteers, they basically planted a lot of exotic things out there. We have some really large, unmanageable planting beds. And what I would be proposing is coming in, taking a fresh look at the plantings around the park entryway area adjacent to the drinking fountain. I don't think we need to do a full planting plan for the whole park. I think it's really just looking at those high profile areas. How can we make them a little bit smaller, a little bit easier to maintain? In addition, we've also recommended a basketball court fence component. So in the initial park plan, we talked about potentially putting a fence around one or two sides of the basketball court, something similar to what we have at Lakefront Park, where you still have the open air feel, but you're not chasing balls down into the parking lot or down onto the street. At the time, we went back and forth. We did increase some plant material in that area. We wanted to see how it worked. But the village removed all the plantings adjacent to the parking lot, really opened that area up. So I was just out at the park today, and you can see people playing basketball, and they're chasing balls down into the parking lot and not onto the street. So I think just from a safe perspective and just a usability perspective, it's something that we would want to look at. Not a huge cost factor in the project. I mean, we're not looking at a closed sports, you know, outfield fence or a huge tennis court fence. It's probably 60 linear feet of fence, something like that. In addition, one of the commissioners has expressed the desire to see some sustainability elements included in the project. We do have a design team that is capable of providing those concepts to the board for future evaluation with price tags attached to them. We do have a $300,000 project budget, which is a placeholder right now, which I think as we continue to develop the project forward, I think we're going to be able to really value and see if those components are something that we, you know, we want to spend taxpayer money on or not. Knowing that, you know, there may be some cutting edge best practices, but there is also some operating expenses that go along with that type of a piece of amenity. So I just open it up to questions now.
Thank you, Chris. Who would have anything for Chris? Dudley, did you want to talk a little bit about your thoughts on this?
The proposal that we have in the agenda packet included an engineering support person with limited experience in sustainability, and since that time, in talking to staff and some other professionals in the field, we've come to the conclusion that perhaps a larger firm who has some experience in this area would be maybe better for outlining what some of the aspects of the improvements might be that would reflect sustainability. There are at least three areas of sustainability to look at. One, of course, is the drainage itself and the stormwater runoff. Area number two is some of the plantings that we're anticipating. And the third area is the electric lighting that we're thinking of looking at. Those are the three major areas that I can think of where there may be a sustainability component worth looking at. I think we're going to get a more formal proposal on that as we go down the line. Isn't that right?
That's correct. To Commissioner Onderdog's point, we worked with our prime consultant, Altamanu, to sub in a different civil engineering firm. So in our dialogue, they've recommended, and we're using a firm called Christopher Burke for the trail. They're a larger firm, significantly more skilled in the areas of stormwater management, and they've agreed to come on as the sub-consultant to Altamanu for the same price as the previous civil engineer, so we would not be paying a markup just because they're a larger firm. We have a pre-existing relationship with them as they're providing us currently the services for resident engineering for our trail project. They also did the trail for the Botanic Gardens, so they're going to be top-notch as far as stormwater management, and I think that we lucked out in getting them at the price that we did.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So what we do is they would come up with designs, and anything what they came up with designs, they'll bring back to the board, and the board's going to discuss if you would like to add any of those sustainability measures into this project. They may or may not be more expensive. They may or may not cost more operational costs in the future. So we'll explain all that when those designs come through and the board can make decisions if they would like to advance or not based on our current budget that's allocated for this project. So what I'm looking for is approval to, or consensus to move this onto the October agenda to approve the ultimate new contract for professional fees and expenses.
Right. This still has to go. You're just asking us to see if we have any questions before it goes to the formal board meeting for approval.
Yeah. I would like to get all the questions out of the way now so that it's really just an official approval process at the board meeting. So
I personally have none, and again, thank you, Chris. This was a very thorough packet.
This is the last meeting. I've sat by the park a few times to look at these elements, and I've seen some events that were happening there, and so doing that and seeing these explanations is making me more comfortable with the added things that we're discussing. I mean, of course, we still have to put numbers to it, and I know that will come further down the line where we can further discuss that and make those decisions, but I think personally for me, this helped me, and taking the time to go there and, you know, look at things has helped.
Yeah. Actually, physically going to some of these spots that we talk about is very effective. So, Dudley, are you good?
Yes, and I'd like to thank staff for the guided tour of the property. It was very helpful to see in place what things were, also to have it explained and pointed out. And thank you, staff, for doing that.
Great. Josh, any thoughts?
As part of Altipa News or Burke's analysis, I'd like to see some consideration for kind of a combination of the planting bed and the sustainability aspect of, you know, if we chose the right plants there, could we avoid putting in the irrigation? Maybe the plants are a little more expensive, but capital expense is eliminated.
I think that's a great point. You know, if it's really deciding, again, what we want. I think that's a good point, Josh. Thank you.
I guess our challenge is the weather here is so unpredictable. It could be horribly rainy season or really, really dry. So I don't know what plant survives that, but that would
be... Well, there's a lot of native plants that actually survive that, but they don't necessarily look like... there's a lot of stuff out there that, you know, does absolutely thrive in that kind of an environment. It's just what your tolerance for something, maybe not having flowers on it for 4th of July is.
Gotcha. Okay, so Josh, you're good with moving it on to the...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I am as well. So Lisa, you've got your marching orders.
Yep.
All right, so if nothing more on Calk, let's move on to other business where Lisa Shepherd will lead the discussion.
Yeah, I just want to actually I'm gonna turn it over to Chris just to give an update on our most current projects that are on everybody's mind. So pretty much the Glyco Trail project in Duke Park. So you want to give us another word of update?
I do. It's a very exciting time. We have a lot going on. The trail itself right now is pretty intimidating because we have a lot of fencing up, a lot of stakes. I think it's probably given some folks palpitations in the last few weeks. But again, what you're seeing right now, the orange fence is a tree protection fence. The black fence is an erosion fence, although the ground, there's not a lot of topography there. It's still required by law. So what we've done is we've laid out the trail. We went and made some small corrections to keep it away from trees that we maybe felt, you know, we wanted to create a little more distance, that type of thing. One thing I will say about the IDOT process, which is what we're going through for the trail project, is it's very laborious. I mean, it is literally pages and pages and pages of things to keep the project moving forward. So something that might take us 2 or 3 hours to review on a regular park project might take, you know, 8 or 9 hours. So we're very lucky to have Burke guiding us through the process and doing a lot of that work for us on our behalf. So we have started to see some movement out on the trail. Today, a big milestone was the fire hydrant at the corner of Park Avenue was moved by Veterans Park, which is the beginning of the process of bisecting the wall there to begin building the trailhead. In addition, we've laid out all the root patterns that will be aerated with the special aeration process to protect the trees. We expect to see some excavations going on in the next 2 weeks. The contractor is doing everything in their power to try to delay that. So, again, we have 48 working days, and after that, they have to pay a fine per day that the job is not done, which IDOT will absolutely charge them. So they are working on a clock. I believe it's $1,800 a day, so I expect that they'll come right in by the finish line here at the end. So It's been a very interesting process so far. In addition, at Duke, if you've been by Duke Park, you can see that the playground equipment is standing. We have some of the layout done. Some of the concrete work that you see is foundations for things like the runnel and the splash pad. So what you're seeing right now isn't a final finished grade. We will also have concrete going down underneath the play equipment, which then gets the rubberized surface on it. So in the next week or so, it's going to look like there's just a lot of concrete out there, but quite a bit of that will be covered with rubberized play surface or the runnel. One of the things that you can see up by Old Green Bay Road right now is the train, the foundation for the train tracks is already laid out, so we're expecting to have the train here shortly, which is very exciting. The project is moving ahead. We're very pleased with the contractor's progress so far. We've had few hiccups outside of their excitement to work outside of our non-traditional working hours here in Glencoe. So we've had to remind them, you know, you can't start before 9 o'clock on weekends, things like that. Typically not problems we have with contractors. Usually you're trying to kick their butt and get them to work. And these guys were trying to say, hey, you know, calm it down a little bit. We don't want to disturb the neighborhood. So one more note, the North Overlook, the Schumann Overlook, that project is proceeding. So those support pillars are in place for the wall. We've had the concrete footings poured for our new section of retaining wall in front of the halfway house. So as you may recall, we replaced 25 feet of the retaining wall. We did determine what the problem with the foundation on the bottom 18 feet of the wall was, and the problem was there was no foundation. So it did last 80-some years. So we definitely got our money's worth out of the design. But I would imagine that what we have out there now will probably last several hundred years. So it's a very, very rigid structure, and likely in the next week we'll see the historical limestone veneers placed back on our wall. So the hope is that it does look the same when the project is completed. So again, Martim has done a great job, and the village has supported us. Staff from the water plant and PW have been very helpful on that project. We've worked together as a great team. So,
Chris, I got a couple questions about when the overlook and the retaining wall will be finished.
That's a great question. I will say early fall. You know, that's like the old 2 weeks, right? What I can tell you, Josh, is that masons will be on site tomorrow. We're doing final selections on the plant material that gets planted on the hill here in the next month. So we are expected to have plantings going in here very shortly. It's a very quick project. I expect, you know, unless we have torrential rainstorms or some type of a strike, for the project to be battened up by the end of October.
Thanks.
Next couple of weeks. Late, early fall, right? I never give a straight answer on those, do I?
With global warming, early fall is a shifting target, too.
Well, it could still be 90 degrees. Like, yeah. You know, it really is just a crapshoot as far as the weather is concerned. I mean, so, but they've got the majority of their concrete poured, and they've got their footings drilled, which was kind of the nail biter, was drilling all these footings next to half the village's water supply. So that was, that took a lot of coordination with PW and the water plant. They did a fine job on that. So it was great to work with them on that project.
Has there been any donations in terms of train cars?
At this time, we're talking to a few people, but we haven't closed any deals. Is that correct, Lisa?
That's correct.
There are some donations on benches, though, correct, Jenny?
Yes.
Yeah.
And how does that work? So, like, obviously on benches you can install the pack later. How does it work on the train cars? Is this something that has to be done now or can be done in the future?
It could be done. Sorry, go ahead, Lisa.
It could be done in the future.
We're looking at what would be best, whether it would be a plaque on the train car or painting a name on it like a boat or an airplane. We're kind of trying to figure that out right now, what would be best.
Dudley,
any other questions on the okay.
I guess I can just ask something real quickly. Can you give us just the real quick, you probably don't have anything, but update on 7N?
You know what, the house was moved on to its permanent foundation, and I understand they had some delays with their contractor, just timing and everything, so that
has not had much progress since then, but they're just trying to get the contractor back out there. Everything was shifted back when, you know, one fell off and another one fell off. They were trying to get on the schedule.
Oh, gotcha. And just very quickly, Chris, you mentioned you're making final decisions on plantings on the overlook. I know the common complaint in years past was that if you sit at the overlook, you can't see the lake because the dogwoods or whatever that, I don't know what it was growing really tall. I presume and assume you know this and are considering height as a, and the flock from the people seated at the overlook as a consideration.
You know, one of the things that we have to take into consideration is the bigger you plant something, as it sinks its roots down in the ground, it's really just more of a it's maintenance. Yeah. I mean, anything left, anything that's going to do the job of helping erosion is going to be bigger than a low grow something in a quart pot. So it really is just a matter of maintenance. You know, I think that's a great point. We have gone back and gone out there and cut it down. 2 years ago when we did the initial sandbagging, we thought that, you know, it was going to be the end of the world that we trimmed all that stuff down and people were going to criticize us and people thought it was great. So I think the takeaway from that is, you know, what we have now will be a lot easier to take care of, and we'll be doing that maintenance on a more regular basis because of that.
Fantastic. Okay, nothing else? And there's nothing else? Lisa?
Bobby may want to get an update on some of the special events that we have scheduled since our last meeting based on commissioners' desire to have those. So, Bob, can I throw that to you?
Absolutely. Well, this Thursday we have a movie at the beach, which is just over half full right now. So the weather looks good for that. We're hoping for a little bit more sign up. We just have over 100 people planning on coming for that on Thursday as of right now. The Spooky Skate was a huge hit and is sold out with a wait list. Obviously, people are very keen to get out of the rink outside of the ice season, so we're very excited. It's going to be a fancy dress, wear your costumes, watch some themed with light and things like that. So we're excited to see that one. Our Halloween Eve event has sold out too. That's the one we do that traditionally replaces Boo Bash the day before Halloween. That again has another massive wait list. We're looking at some fun fitness outdoor based smaller events for November, including some we call it turkey gobbler, some day after Thanksgiving fitness classes outside, just to get basically the feedback of the board, people outside as much as possible. Shannon and Liz are working on a basketball skills based tournament, which is happening in the middle of this month, which almost two of those sessions are full. So we're still seeing a lot of desire for the community to get out. We also got a lot of very positive feedback on the doggy dip. People were really excited to get down to the beach with their pets. So we've got another one of those coming up. And you know, we just look to add any little event we can that is good return on our investment and also keeps people safe and gets people outdoors.
I stopped by the last movie night and got to see Miss Christman, among others, and it looked awesome. I didn't realize y'all like stepped up your game and got a real screen and real speakers, and man, it looked really cool and people seemed really happy. So nice job on that, Bobby and Stephanie.
Yeah, the team has been really trying to innovate and generate a lot of good ideas. Even if you were at that movie, they learned from the first one and got balloons which had LED lights inside of them, so people could actually see what spots were available. So a safer way of people getting to their spots when it got dark. So really love the innovation going on right now, and then Liz is executing all these really great ideas. So,
yeah, great job.
Yeah, thank you.
I think that is it. The rest of the program updates will be at our board meeting.
Okay. No one has any more to say, then I entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
The roll call vote, please.
Member Boren?
Yes.
Member Covey?
Yes.
Member Ludden?
Yes.
Member Underdog?
Yes.
Chair Brooks?
Yes. Motion passes.
All right, 8:55. Thank you all.
Everyone.